Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, published the day after Christmas, 2012. Our best of 2012. Triangulation is brought to you by Pond5, the world's stock media marketplace. If you're a media maker looking for video, photos, illustrations, music, sound effects, After Effects templates, or 3D models, check out Pond5. And for an exclusive 50 free stock media files, go to pond5.com/triangulation. And by audible.com. To download the free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. And don't forget to get your free copy of Brian Sanderson's Legion at audible.com/Sanderson. And by Ford, featuring Bliss, the blind spot information system with cross-traffic alert and active park assist. Check out these available features on the 2013 Ford Fusion and 2013 Ford Taurus. And learn more at ford.com/technology. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Triangulation, the show that interviews some of the most interesting, smartest, most intriguing people on the Internet. This is our holiday special Triangulation for Boxing Day. That means we couldn't get any guests. So what we decided to do is we've got recordings of all the previous shows. You probably do, too. But you don't have a crack editor paring them down and making them pithy and well thought out, and neither do we. Nevertheless, what you're about to see is the best of Triangulation. Some of our most interesting guests. Actually, there's a ton of good stuff. It's going to be hard to choose. But first, before we get into that, maybe I should mention one of our sponsors on Triangulation. They have a special offer for the holidays. We're talking about Pond5, the world's stock media marketplace. If you're a media maker and you need, you know, you're doing a blog or a website, videos, you're doing PowerPoint presentations, or even if you're doing apps, you need sound effects, you need music, you need pictures, you need 3D models, vector illustrations, motion graphics templates. There is a great place to go that's full of the best content. It's called Pond5, P-O-N-D, the number 5.com. You'll get royalty-free media. That means you pay for it once. It's yours to use in any way you see fit, and that's a great deal. The other thing is you can be sure that the content creators themselves are getting a great deal because Pond5 pays the best royalties in the business and lets the creators set their own prices. So it's a great deal for content creators, a great deal for people who make media, make PowerPoint presentations, make keynote presentations. All the content on Pond5 can be downloaded instantly for legal use in virtually any media production at the best prices anywhere. And look at the variety. Millions of images, music, sound effects. They've got a great browser that makes it very easy for you to find what you want. Frankly, it's fun because as you browse around, you go, that would be great. Oh, I could use that. You know, it's actually a creative resource. Trying to figure out how to best illustrate an idea, browse Pond5. You'll get some great ideas. Plus, they pay 50% royalties for each and every sale, which is the best payout in the industry. So you're making everybody happy by shopping Pond5. Many Pond5 users are also Pond5 sellers. Get 50 stock media files free right now at pond5.com/triangulation. That's our special holiday deal. A great way to sample Pond5 without paying a penny. Just set up a Pond5 account. Go to pond5.com/triangulation. You can download all 50. They have a great downloader. Makes it very easy. Now they're yours to keep forever. Use in any way you see fit. pond5.com/triangulation. I'll be back in a minute with a little bit more, but let's get right into it with Triangulation and some of our best guests from 2012. Welcome to Triangulation, the show where, oh, I love this show. I love this show. We get the best, most interesting people in the technology industry to sit down for an hour and talk about what they're doing, what their big ideas are. It's very relaxed, very informal, and a lot of fun. I've been anxious to get our guest today on the show for some time now. Lamour Fried is very well known in the maker community. as the founder of Adafruit Industries, adafruit.com. She's Miss Adafruit, and she is a hacker, an engineer, and an inspiration for people who just want to take stuff and do stuff with it. Lamour, thank you so much for being here on a Triangulation.
Thank you for having us, me on the show. Sorry we couldn't schedule this earlier. We've been so busy here at Adafruit, and I'm really glad that we finally got an hour that of intersecting.
Yay!
We could get together and do the show.
You're in the Adafruit warehouses in Manhattan right now.
That's right. Right now, I'm broadcasting from the Adafruit storage warehouse. You can see we store oscilloscopes.
Cool.
We have this awesome resistor chart that's embroidered onto a pillow, and then some more boxes. And yeah, we're downtown in Manhattan. We're a couple blocks from the World Trade Center in the Financial District. So it's really exciting to be here in New York. Weather's not as good as Petaluma, but
that's all right. It's probably burning hot there right now.
It's pretty hot.
Yeah, that's all right. Hey, it's fun because you're clearly somebody, and I love talking to people like you who are living the dream. They're living, they're following their bliss. They're doing what they really care about. When did you get interested in electronics and hacking and this kind of stuff?
I've been doing electronics for, almost a decade or more now. I started it when I was at school.
High school?
No, actually college. I got into it in college.
Were you a geek in high school?
I was a geek in high school, and like modems had just been invented. So that was like BBSs and stuff. And that was cool. And then the internet was kind of like, by the time I was about to graduate, like people were using the internet, and that was really awesome. And then I went to college, and I was actually studying computer science.
At MIT, I might add.
At MIT. And yeah. It was really fun. And I really enjoyed Core 6, which is what I was studying. But I kept getting really excited by all these electronic projects that I saw people building, especially on campus. And so that's why I decided to change my major kind of like as a junior. I was like, okay, take a right turn.
Wow.
And let's do electrical engineering. And electrical engineering is really my passion. It was so much fun. I kept building projects just for fun and putting them up on my webpage. And then back then, like people read Slashdot a lot. And so these projects would get posted on Slashdot, and then people would email me and say, wow, this like DIY MP3 player is so cool. I want to also build my own MP3 player. And could you like sell me a pack of kits, parts, or something? I can build it because I have instructions, but like you have to go to all these places and like buy, you know, resistors here and the chip there and like an SD card holder from this company. So people kept asking me for kits. And that's where Adafruit came from, is me building projects and then developing these kits that people can build and then putting them on the website and then people build them. So we have hundreds of projects and tutorials and kits all over the Adafruit site for people to learn from.
Are you still handling a soldering iron, or do you have people do that now for you?
I have a great team of people, and we have some people in production, but I still do a lot of the building. I still build all the prototypes. I still test everything that goes in the store. I still write a majority of the documentation.
Wow.
Yeah, we actually just recently came out with what we think is like the best tutorial system, because we want to teach people electronics.
Right.
So we like wrote from scratch, because we've been using WordPress and wikis and like Instructables, and they're all really good and they all have their strengths. But we wanted something that was like WordPress, the ease of WordPress, but for teaching people stuff.
Mm.
And we developed our own educational system at learn.adafruit.com. And it's kind of this awesome mashup of like Pinterest and like blogging and like lots of big images everywhere. And it's just awesome. We just released it and we have like 50 tutorials up already, and it's just so cool. And we're going to open source it, you know, as soon as it's ready to be released.
This is great. It is. It's a Pinterest for people who want to learn circuits and build stuff. That's awesome.
Yeah. It's all just like you're learning stuff, not just buying shoes. So that's.
Yeah. Look at this cool stuff.
Click on any of these, and I have some of these to show off too. Some of these projects.
Oh, good.
You want to see?
We'll show some stuff here. This is. So let me ask you about this. So, is it a political thing? Why do you want to teach people electronics? Just because you love it, or do you have a greater goal?
I just love teaching people stuff, and people love to learn, and everyone is so creative, I think.
Yeah.
And people want to learn how to build this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I went to school and I studied like for 6 years, electrical engineering, did a master's in it. And that's great if you want to learn how to like bias a transistor. But a lot of people are just like, well, I want to build like some bike lights for, you know, my bike, and I want to bed them in the handlebar. And I want to make it so you don't have to go to school. It's like some people are like, you know, they've already gone to school and they've learned something, or they're too young. We have a lot of people who visit our site and follow our tutorials who are, you know, they're only like 8-10 years old.
Yay.
And they're awesome. They're just like rocking out. They're like, I built this quadcopter.
Oh, look at that. That's bright. Nobody's going to run into you that, with that one.
This is a really easy project, but it still teaches you a lot. It's this flexible LED strip, and you have to solder to it, and you have to build a battery pack. And so you learn about current consumption and voltage and how to power LEDs, and you know, and you wrap it with clear bar tape. And so this is our demo. And Becky did an awesome video for this, so you can check it out later if you want.
Learn.adafruit.com. It's on there.
Check it out. Yeah, it's like the one that looks like this. But yeah, so these are, we have projects that are really simple like this. This is like a 2-hour project that a beginner can do, up to like, you know, massive like week-long endeavors.
I hope you're enjoying this best of triangulation. I think it's one of the shows I love doing most because it's a chance for me to go out and ask people that I really want to talk to. Hey, can I spend some time with you? And normally they would just laugh, but because I can say it's a show, sometimes they say yes. We've got some more great guests in a bit. Before we do, though, I'd like to talk about one of my favorite companies ever, Audible.com. They saved my life. You know, when I was working in San Francisco, this was almost 10 years ago, I was driving each way from here in Petaluma. That's an hour each way with no traffic. It could sometimes be 4 hours a day on the road. I would have just gone crazy if I hadn't had Audible.com. In fact, I came to love my commute because Audible let me listen to great books while I'm in the car. I don't commute anymore, but I still download 2 Audible books a month just because I love it so much. And I just make a point of putting it on while I'm doing housework or at the gym, when I'm driving the kids to school. I find a time to listen to Audible.com almost every day. And that's what's great about it. It brings reading literature back into my life. Audible has 100,000 plus books in every genre, fiction, of course, novels, thrillers, mysteries, science fiction, but also nonfiction. I love history, economics. Audible, it fills my mind. I have kind of this pattern I do now while I'll read a fiction book. I'm reading a book Trey Ratcliffe told me to read that I just cannot recommend more highly. I'll tell you about that in a second. And then after I finish the fiction book, I do a nonfiction book. My next one is going to be Sylvia Nasser's book about, I think it's called The Dismal Science. It's about economics. And she was the one who wrote the great book about John Nash, the mathematician. What was that called? Something Mind. It was such a good book.
Beautiful Mind.
Remember the movie? Well, she wrote a great nonfiction biography of him, which I highly recommend. Anyway, that's on Audible. That's my next read. So I've got a fiction book and a nonfiction book. Let me tell you about the fiction book, though. And I got to say, Trey Ratcliffe, on Triangulation, I think it was, told me, he said, this is the greatest book of all time, and I use this as a litmus test. I tell people about it. I let them watch it or listen to it, and I ask them what they think. And if they don't like it, I don't want to be their friend. Really? I said, really? But Trey, I'm already your friend. He said, well, tell me what you think of this book. And I thought, oh my gosh, I better like it. It's a book by a guy named Patrick Rothfuss. Perhaps you've seen them interview him on Sword and Laser. It's wonderful. It's called The Name of the Wind, Day One of the Kingkiller Chronicles. So I know there's more, which is great. And at first I thought, oh, this is going to be kind of a standard sword and sorcery fantasy book, you know. It is perhaps one of the most literate, well thought out, well plotted, consistent universe, in gripping, engrossing books I've ever read. Trey, of course, has the best taste. He's absolutely right. And I highly recommend this as your first Audible book. Would you like to get it free? You can. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/triangulation, you're going to be signing up for the gold account. That's a book a month. But your first month is free. Your first book is free. You can cancel at any time, pay nothing, and it's yours to keep. And this would be a great first choice. Very well read. The guy who reads it brings it to life. And it's just it's a different, you know, kind of fantastical world. It's kind of like Game of Thrones a little bit, a little more fantastical, but beautifully crafted and very, I just love it. I had never read anything by Patrick Rothfuss before, and now I'm a huge fan. So, just, you know, if you like that kind of book, kind of the fantasy, sword and sorcery, magical book. He was on SFW, too. Wow. Does Brian know him? I'm so jealous. He's a friend of the network. Patrick. That's not his name, though. It's Rothfuss. Is it Patrick Rothfuss? Patrick, whatever your name is, I love you. And I want to know you and have your children. What a great book, The King Killer Chronicles by Patrick Rothfuss. Highly recommend it. Anyway, get it free, audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. And I guess I can stay friends with Trey Ratcliffe because I like his book. I like the book he recommended. Let's get back. I don't know who the next interview is. We'll find out. Triangulation, the best of 2012, continues. Watch.
Somebody I just adore is here. He is a comedian. He is a failed literary agent. I don't know if failed.
Now, wait a minute. Failed.
A highly successful.
Former professional literary agent. I sold a book at least.
Did you?
Sure.
John Hodgman is with us, and it's on the celebratory occasion of the audio and paperback version of his most recent book.
Neither of which is that. This is the hardcover edition.
Yeah, I have the expensive high quality.
Right, because
it's hard.
That's the tough one.
Is All, which is the third in the trilogy of
Complete World Knowledge.
Everything you'd ever want to know.
Right.
And this one focuses particularly on the end of the world, which is coming in December, Ragnarok.
That's why you need both editions, because this one, after the collapse of civilization, is useful as a... This is a weapon.
Perfect. That could be...
Say,
ow!
Whereas the soft cover is more useful as fuel.
Fuel?
Yeah. Burns more easily.
And what would you use the audiobook for?
Consolation.
Yeah. Yeah, and you'll need that.
What a pleasure to be here.
Such a thrill to have you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah, were the lights bothering your eyes?
Is that... No. I'm sorry about that. This is a nice setup you have here in Petaluma.
Thank you very much.
I tried to dress for Petaluma.
Yeah, you look Western. You got a Western shirt, little flowers. That's beautiful.
I'm going to raise some chickens after
Pearl
this.
Pearl buttons. Are you in town for...
I'm in town for this.
For this?
Don't you understand?
There's nothing else going on in Petaluma.
I flew across the country to be here with
you. Thank
you.
It's so great.
Because, you know, you talked to my friend Jonathan Colton.
I did last week.
And we've spoken all the time, you and I. I'm such a fan.
You're a regular on our holiday special.
That's true.
Yeah. So two or three years running, we consumed huge amounts of Jägermeister.
But I couldn't be here for it because I live in my...
Brooklyn.
My survival brownstone in Park Slope.
And Chateau Marmont.
And so I couldn't drink with you.
Yeah.
And Colton, you know, Colton and I, we would watch the... Am I allowed to say the network that you
the Tech TV? The Tech TV. Yeah, of course.
Or is just the spite too great?
The spite is great.
Yeah.
In this one,
I agree. Spite is great. But long before any of this, and of course, long before any of this, Jonathan Colton and I would watch you on that show.
You were that young; you couldn't grow facial hair.
Yeah, I can barely. the only reason this is happening is because I can't grow a beard. Like this is literally every whisker that I have is deployed now.
You should be grateful. You have a boyish visage. It's good.
I look like a weird mustached baby.
Exactly.
It's not a
strange amount of hair.
But Colton and I we watch you on that all the time. And Colton is always the guy who would tell me what's what with regard to the computers.
Yeah, he was.
Colton
your technical
is to me
expert.
As you are to the rest of the to the whole world. Mm-hmm.
Jonathan, you know, he's a programmer. He's very technical.
And I would watch him. You would talk some gobbledygook about computers and so forth. But I appreciate you because you are a broadcasting professional. You have probably the greatest radio voice that I've ever heard.
Thank you very much. Why am I not on your audiobook?
Well, because...
You've got Dick Cavett?
Yeah.
My hero?
Lives in New York.
Ah.
Rachel Maddow lives in New York.
Lives in New York.
John Hamm comes to New York from time to time.
Of Mad Men fame. What did John Hamm do on the audiobook?
There is a so the audiobook of That Is All has come out. Now That Is All is my third and final book of complete world knowledge after The Areas of My Expertise and More Information Than You Require. Those were the first two.
Yes.
And this one covers everything that I didn't cover in those. The two subjects that that I previously refused to cover, wine, because it's disgusting, and sports, because everyone else is covering it.
Right.
And I don't know anything about it until now. Wealth, which I know a little bit about. And the end of the world, which we should all be concerned about, because the Mayans, as you know, are threatening our livelihood by predicting that the world is going to end on December 21st of this year.
Yes.
Leaving the earth consumed by fire and flood and famine, leaving only John Cusack alive, like we've seen in the movies.
Yes. Yeah. How fortunately, if this book would help you as a guide to surviving those days.
Well, I think it might ease the pain as existence comes to an end.
Oh, so it's really not, there's nothing more after this in John Cusack.
Well, we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen on December 21st. It could be that, as I predict, the world suffers a huge electromagnetic omega pulse. Massive solar storms reverse the Earth's polarity. The century toad cracks the Earth in half, and we're all consumed by the blood wave. Or it could be an awakening of consciousness, or nothing at all. But either way, this book will prepare you for
I got to point out, the blood wave is supposed to begin in just 3 days.
Yeah, well.
So the clock is ticking down.
You had better find a house that is at least 5,000 feet above sea level, or get a houseboat.
When does the century toad strike? Is that later?
That's later. The century toad is almost at the very end.
I don't want to be a killjoy, but I do have to point out, as we go back in time, for instance, September 27th, which has already passed, the sky over Montana finally collapses, crushing all below it. That didn't happen.
Well, they're covering it up.
Oh, it did happen?
Yeah. It fell down, and now the government has covered up the sky with a tarp.
See?
I brought you something, by the way, on this.
Oh, real mayonnaise.
This is mayonnaise.
You know, I've been using that fake stuff for so long.
Well, that's actually from your refrigerator here. Because I realized I came empty-handed.
It's chilly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's usually, mayonnaise is usually better that way. When you're stocking your survival bunker, there are a couple things that you want to have.
Yeah.
And you want to start stockpiling mayonnaise now, because it's a terrific hair conditioner.
Mm-hmm.
It's a natural topical analgesic. If you get a sunburn, you can put mayonnaise on your, if you got a sunburned face, you put mayonnaise on your face, and then it doubles as a quick short-term albino mask. And also, you spread it out on some garbage bags and put it out on the lawn. You get a slip and slide.
So this is really many uses.
Yeah. You leave it out in the sun for a while, it becomes a handy poison.
1,001 uses. Yeah.
The only other thing that's more useful than mayonnaise is urine.
Okay.
To stockpile. And I left some of that for you here as well.
I noticed.
Yeah.
The bathroom door was locked for a very long time. So
wine, wealth, sports, the end of the world.
Get us back on track.
That is all.
It's all in here.
And the audiobook has come out for download only via Audible. Are you familiar?
Yes, I am
familiar
so very
with them?
Familiar. In fact, we have
buzz
some
marketing.
We have some buzz. You design ASICs for them, that kind of thing, or?
Yeah, I do. I design mobile phone graphics chips.
Oh, how interesting.
Including the one in the Raspberry Pi, in fact.
Ah, well, let's talk about it. So just for those who don't know, Raspberry Pi is a $25 computer. And it runs Linux, and it has RCA video in. It has out, I should say. Is it out or in?
Out.
Out.
And they're all out.
They're all out. Audio out. USB, mm-hmm. Ethernet. It's got an HDMI port. 256 megs of RAM, a CPU, a GPU, Broadcom, an SD card slot, $25, and it is, you can't keep them in stock.
Yeah, that's if we've got a problem, it's that we can't keep them in stock. So the one you describe is the one you describe is a $35 one. It's the deluxe model.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The $25 one lacks the network.
Ah, okay. So if you need a LAN, it's $10 more.
Yeah.
So tell us the story of Raspberry Pi. How did this come about?
A group of us who were teaching. So this is kind of a University of Cambridge spin out, right? So a group of us who were involved in recruiting school kids, recruiting undergraduates to come and study computer science in about 2005, noticed that all of a sudden we had no people applying to read computer science. that in 10 years we'd gone from having six times as many people as we needed, and where all of those people, even the ones we turned down, were amazingly well-informed about computers, you know, knew how to program. They had their Commodore 64s and their Amigas, and they knew how to program them in assembly language. And we'd gone from that down to a situation where we maybe only had two or three times as many as we needed, and that's actually kind of by Cambridge standards pretty bad. The vast majority of them had maybe done a little bit of web programming. And we kind of looked around for reasons why this might have happened. The idea we came on was that, there weren't any Commodore 64s anymore, right?
Interesting. And so this
is really supposed to provide kids with that kind of turn it on, goes beep, start programming experience that we had back in the 1980s.
So you think kids today are, it's just too easy. They don't have to do anything. Everything's been written for them. It's an the technology's become appliances.
Yeah, absolutely. And the kind of computer as appliance thing is a really, it's kind of terrible. It's a good sign on some level because it means that computers have, as you say, got kind of easier to use. But it does mean that it's starving academia and it's starving industry of the people who we need to make the next generation of cool appliance stuff.
Right.
So you need to have a balance between appliance and general purpose computing.
So what were the design specifications? What did you aim for? Was it cheap?
So let's say four things. We wanted to be interesting. So we didn't just want to be a machine for programming. We wanted to be able to do other interesting stuff. So we can play Blu-ray quality video, right? We can play 1080p Blu-ray quality video onto your 46-inch plasma television.
Wow.
We have more 3D performance than a Nintendo Wii. So we kind of have these things that are interesting, that kind of hooks to get kids, to pull kids into the platform. So that was one thing. We wanted to be programmable, so we wanted to be able to bundle this device with every programming tool you've ever heard of, whether those are things for little kids, like Logo, intermediate people like maybe MIT Scratch, or real professional languages like Python and C. So we wanted to have that. We wanted to be robust, so we wanted to be able to push this into a school bag every day for 5 years and pull it out, and it would be robust enough that it would survive that. And finally, we wanted it to be cheap. And I mean, I guess that to some extent, cheapness has driven the entire program. So, you know, we had this idea, $25. The original device we were thinking about was the one without the network. And we've only added a network because everyone told us that the first thing they'd do with the $25 one would be to stick a network adapter on it. And that would cost a lot more than $10. So we were like, well, we can add this. We can give you this for $10. If 90% of you want it, we'll do the $25 version, but we will have the, we'll bundle you a network adapter for $10. So we had this idea of $25, and that was supposed to be the cost of a school textbook, which kind of shows how badly informed we are, really. I guess,
yeah,
about.
They're about 10 times more, but okay.
No, I mean, that wouldn't have been such an exciting challenge, I guess.
Yeah, so, no.
it's good that we're poorly informed, otherwise we would never.
You could buy an Nexus 7 tablet for the cost of a school textbook.
Yeah, absolutely. If we'd known people were prepared to pay that, we would have sold the existing Raspberry Pi for $250.
Was it difficult to do it at $25 and then $35? Was that hard to do?
Incredibly, incredly hard. I mean, it's taken us about 6 years from concept to production. And we've tried a lot of different prototypes, kind of hunting for that mix, those four things. And we've had a lot of things that satisfy two or three of those four, but it was only really in the last year that we've come up with something that satisfies all four. So, yeah, it was extremely difficult. I have my own, one of our trustees, we're a UK charity, and one of my trustees is a real kind of Steve Wozniak kind of guy, and he really kind of just beavered away at this for the last couple of years, getting the final version down to cost and up to performance.
Is that Paul Beech or?
Aha! So Paul Beech, he beavered away. He produced our logo.
Ah.
So Paul Beech is our Paul Beech is responsible for the fact that we have some of, I think, for an amateur project. We have some of the best graphic design, some of the best identity of any project that I'm aware of.
And even the name Raspberry Pi is part of the success, right? There are other computers named after fruit, but nobody after raspberries.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, that's to some extent the fact they are running out of fruit, right? We could, you know, durian sandwich or something. But, you know, durian, Ethereums don't smell so good. So, you know, we ended up being Raspberry because it's one of the few ones that's left, and Pi because we were going to run Python. That was the idea originally.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's, it was PY, not PI.
Well, that's the thing. You see, we thought the PI, we thought the Pi symbol would give us a really nice, some really nice graphic design possibilities. Mm-hmm. We ran a the way we got our logo was we ran a contest that Paul won, and what we saw was here we go that everybody who submitted that's actually a Buckyball. That's a C6.
Oh my God, it is. Oh, how interesting.
The Buckyball has 32 vertices, I think. So the 32 vertices are for 32-bit. You can see 11 of those vertices here, and those are the ARM. Those are the 11 in ARM 11, which is the processor that we have. So the whole thing, he sent us this whole pack of information about the meaning buried in the design.
He really thought about it. Wow!
All the people who used that Greek letter, all the people who used the pi, they ended up. They looked very forced. Right. We didn't get a single entry that we felt we could accept that had a pi symbol. So it was a waste of time in the end. We might as well have been Raspberry Py, particularly because a lot of people have trouble calling it Raspberry Pi, right? People are very resistant to calling it Raspberry Pi. People call it Raspberry Pi, like Magnum PI. You know, I don't know. It's right there. It's a joke.
Pi.
You know, it's even capital P, lowercase I. It's not capital P, capital I. And there's no full stops between them, and there's no guy with them stamped. So, you know, it's kind of, it should be obvious, but it seems not to be.
It strikes me that some of the inventions that made this possible was, well, the predominance of mobile devices, particularly phones, you're in many ways taking advantage of all the development that's gone into mobile parts, like the ARM chip, Broadcom itself.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's no way a little organization like ours could have afforded to tape out a chip. You know, I have a reasonable idea what it costs to tape out a chip, and, you know, we weren't going to be doing that. Right. So we were very lucky, A, that there was a device, A, that there was the whole concept of small ARM-based mobile chips, B, that there was a particular device, and C, that Broadcom's been very supportive. You know, they've allowed us to do this. This is not a run-of-the-mill activity for Broadcom. So, you know, we've been very lucky in a lot of ways.
That's neat. So they did help you out.
Yeah, you know, they've been very supportive. Simply allowing us to do it, right, I'm just grateful we were allowed to do it.
What do you mean allowed to do it? Could anybody just buy parts and build something? Or?
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that typically parts like this don't tend to be available. We started off, when we were first doing this, we thought we were going to make 1,000 of these, right? You typically can't buy mobile phone chips in 1,000 off.
Right.
You know, it's not that they tend to be expensive in 1,000 off. It's that they often tend to be unavailable in 1,000 off.
Right.
So that's when I say allowed us to do it. What I mean is, you know, we're prepared to sell them to us in by phone companies now as small quantities.
So it's a Broadcom system on a chip,
mm-hmm.
ARM 11, floating point, 700 megahertz.
Hmm. Yeah, although we know a lot of people are overclocking these, right? It's got some overclocking headroom. So,
awesome.
There's a lot of people running gigahertz Raspberry Pis out there.
Wow. You've got – tell me about the GPU. It says Video Core 4. This is your bailiwick, isn't it?
Yeah, so this is absolutely – this is my baby. This is particularly the 3D core in there. I was on the design team for the 3D core, and it's an amazingly powerful. This is a chip that came out in 2000. The first incarnation is came out in 2009. It's only really in the last 6 months, I think, that we've seen cores from other vendors which have come anywhere close to it.
Amazing.
So it's an enormously powerful device, and it's one that I know it very intimately. I'm quite good at getting a lot of performance out of it.
Yeah,
I know it's cool.
Yeah, runs OpenGL, runs OpenVG.
Yeah,
and as you said, it'll play back a Blu-ray disc at full resolution, 40 megabits a second.
Yeah, it's you know, it does the whole whatever it is, 62.5 megabits. Was it that level 4.1?
Wow.
I used to be before I was a 3D geek. I was a video geek, but yeah, I think it plays level 4.1. So it's quite something for the kind of money that you're paying for this. We're not done yet in terms of turning on the multimedia features. So we've just announced that we're producing a camera module, a 5-megapixel camera module. There's an optional feature that we hope to provide for between $20 and $25. And that'll let you record Blu-ray quality H.264 videos. That'll let you record 1080p 30 video.
So tell us about the Twitter book, because this is you've only been on Twitter a couple of years, right?
Yeah, actually not even. It's about a year and a half, I guess. And you know, I started. Well, I'm going to go through the history. Here's the book. Where is it?
I have it.
It's called. It. It's what is it called? Because you didn't send
it's
me.
It's called.
One.
Oh wait, that's a notepad. Sorry.
What's the original version?
You know, this is the book. And the title, I think I made a mistake with the title because this was I actually tweeted this title. I said I'm working on my book, The 10 Make That 9 Habits of Very Organized People Make That 10. And it was, you know, it was really funny as a tweet. And I've actually learned that Twitter is its own thing. I thought when I first started it would translate and I would find material for our banjo show or things I might do on Letterman or Leno, and it didn't work out that way. Twitter is Twitter. I think it's really funny in a book form, especially, and I found that as I was writing, I really enjoyed people's responses, but I didn't realize that until 6 months in, because I was so new to it. I didn't really know how it worked, and I didn't even know to read people's responses. And once I did, I found them to be really, really funny. And I found that there was a dialogue flowing that was like nothing I had ever experienced in comedy. Hmm. And that's why I thought it would make a good book. So, you know, and the book in that sense has a little bit of a narrative to it. You can watch me kind of go from a solo act, you know, to a group act.
Huh.
And I still, I as I look at the book, even after it was done, I thought, I really, really like this. I feel it's like it's something new happening that's kind of unprecedented for me in comedy.
You know, there's so many social media consultants out there pitching themselves and charging for seminars about how to make the perfect Twitter post and how to engage your audience. You took to this perfectly naturally. In my opinion, you're probably one of the handful of people who use Twitter exactly right, at least for my tastes. What you write is always pithy. It's entertaining. It's you know, it's not annoying. How did you approach it? Because you didn't come at it as like, well, I'm a social media consultant and this is, you know, the formula for my posts. Mm-hmm. What were you thinking when you're like, well, this is how I'm going to use this tool?
Well, I had no idea. At first, I thought... I actually write about it in my foreword. I thought, gee, I'm going on the David Letterman show, for example, which let's say has an audience of 4 million. And let's say I'm going to talk about a book I wrote. And I found out, you know, there's a lot of overkill. Because how many people out of 4 million,
right,
one, can read?
Slice it right in half right there. Yeah.
No, and or how many people would be interested in a book or interested looking for a book, and then how many would be interested in a book by me? So you start to whittle it down, and I kind of guessed that, you know, maybe I way overestimated the impact. I thought, well, maybe 1% might be interested. That might mean 40,000 books, but it's way, way less than that, because I'm interested, you know, I worked very hard on the book. I'm interested in having people read them. And, but it's way less. It's not even 0.1%. So I thought, well, with Twitter, at least I'm talking to people who are interested in me. But as I got into it, I found, you know, I get slightly embarrassed in talking about product. And so I couldn't do it very often. Now I've gotten a little bolder, you know. With this is the most actually I've ever talked about a product in my whole life on Twitter.
And it's not much; it's a couple of tweets. I mean, it's...
yeah, it really is. And you know, and like for example, I get requests. I got requests, you know, from friends saying, "Can you tweet about my book?"
Right.
And I said no, because I think it turns off the audience.
I agree.
And I realize, hey, I've got something funny going here that I really enjoy doing and the audience really enjoys it. And I'm not going to – I just can't turn it into a commercial thing. So the lesson I learned, you know, thinking that I was, you know, talking directly to an audience, thinking that if I have like 2 million followers and I tweet about a book, let's see, that should mean I sell 2 million books. No, it's like the same ratio as doing a television show. You maybe sell, you know – 1,000 books. Right. You can't win. So it's really it's really just kind of fun. It's really its own world, and I'm lucky that I can make time to do it. And I used to kind of stress a little bit about it, and now I don't.
Well, one of the things that I noticed that you do, which I think one of the keys is that you're thinking about what you would think if you read your own post. Is that fair to say?
I don't know. I don't know. I just think of something. Sometimes I think it's time to tweet something, and then I'll come up with something, and then it turns into a kind of a role.
Well, you just posted about appearing on Tavis Smiley, but instead of saying, "Hey, come watch me on Tavis Smiley," it's funny. It's I'm on Tavis Smiley tonight on PBS, unless that wasn't Tavis Smiley and wasn't PBS. Shot in garage and interviewed by very high rapper guy.
It does suit your style of humor, though, Steve, because you tend to do those kind of, as I remember, short, non-sequitur humor. I think your early jokes fitted to 140 characters, whether you knew it or not. Is that
could
right?
have, and I did jump around quite a bit. I mean, not jump, well, I did both,
you
literally.
Did both, yes.
And figuratively.
You were bouncy, yeah. And you had short attention span.
Yeah, so, but really, you know, what I find so funny were the responses, and that's one of the two reasons that I donated all my profits in this book to charity, because one, I felt funny making money off something that's so public, mm-hmm. And two, because I do quote other people, I didn't want to make money off them.
So people's replies to you on Twitter are also in the book.
Yes, and we got permission largely from everybody that we could find.
You did try to contact as many people as you could.
Yes, we contacted as many people as we could.
Some of your dialogue on Twitter is with other comics, Albert Brooks,
Weird Al. That. Yeah.
But most of it is with real people, and I think people are often shocked. You do something a lot of celebrities don't do. You really engage. You talk to people.
Sometimes I'll reply to people. I never retweeted with a reply, because actually Twitter makes it quite, it's a little bit difficult.
Right.
If you're going to retweet, I haven't quite figured out if I retweet, it just sends it out.
Right.
Yeah. On the web.
So you have to reply, and then, I don't know, I still haven't figured out. I have another service that makes it easier, called Husay. So I'm still a little nervous about doing that. But I'm looking for something that that a guy...
Somebody in our chat room said, you know, we're the beneficiaries, because we get to... It's so rare to get to engage in a two-way street with somebody that, you know, like Steve Martin, and joke around with him.
Well, our template is set by the expectation of you write a fan letter,
right,
and it gets put in a big pile, and then you get a form letter back from a publicist saying thank you for writing, and that's kind of the engagement we expect. Whereas Twitter just gets rid of all that.
Well, it's also
go ahead. I do read almost all the replies. You know, it's so funny that. When I had, just reading, so I can't read it on the air.
He enjoys the book. This is good, Steve. Go ahead, just read it to yourself and laugh. I think that's good. That's a good.
I mean, I'm reading a reply. I'm not reading my own things. I'm still looking for this one.
Your own things are good too, though.
Steve Martin's book. While he's looking, I'll tell you is the 10. Make that 9. Habits very organized. I think you did this just to get people like Conan O'Brien to have to read this whole title. The 10, make that 9, Habits of Very Organized People, make that 10, The Tweets of Steve Martin. It's available on Amazon and every $10.87 on Amazon. There's a Kindle edition. Do you read the audio edition?
No, I thought it wouldn't work as an audio book, you know, because it's in different voices. You know, there's my voice and then there's the responder's voice, and I thought it was kind of weird.
Just do funny voices.
Yeah, I could do that, but I don't know.
People in our chat room are dying for you to do an audiobook. There's like several people asking.
They're making – Steve, I hate to tell you, but it says it will be released on June 5th.
Oh.
An audiobook?
Yeah.
It does?
Yeah.
Maybe they did one without me knowing it.
I think they snuck it in. Maybe they just say, hey, Steve, read this. Okay, now read this.
Don't read paragraph 5 of that contract. That's
for example, here's just a brief little one that I think the response is actually funnier than my tweet. I tweeted about my record, Rare Bird Alert. I said, Rare Bird Alert number 3 on Amazon. I'm happy as a clam. Wait, are clams really happy? And then a man wrote back and said, or someone wrote back and said, the chilling sound of clam laughter has caused many fishermen to quit the sea. It's pretty well written, too.
That's great.
It is. You know? It's poetic. So you were on Looney Games. He had tricked you into becoming cartoonists. And you're off to the races. What happened that moved you into your own site? And why didn't you decide, like, oh, you know, this was fun, but now it's come to an end?
You know, it's funny. It has, you know, like so many great things, it has a lot to do with the F word.
Mm-hmm. Fun.
Yeah. No, not that one. There's another
Other funners?
No. So what happened was, you know, a comic strip as a form, generally speaking, is, you know, as an American institution, it lives on the paper, right? Specifically like a newspaper. And that's even more true, you know, back in 98 when we were doing that stuff, right? I mean, now that's not really a thing. That medium is in super trouble. But back then, you know, you could aspire to that. And there are, you know, editorial guidelines that go into the creation of that type of content so that it can be presentable everywhere. And we didn't really want to be presentable everywhere. It seemed like we had an opportunity to do things that you couldn't do in a newspaper strip. And one of those would be to use, you know, the regular kind of language that we use every day.
Yeah, just talk like people talk, in other words.
Yeah, that's at any rate, talk the way we talk. Some people don't do that.
Sure.
But that's totally normal for us. And so we included what you might, you know, what Dragon might call natural language.
Cursing?
That's right. Yeah. In the body of the strip. And we were told that the F word was not funny and that we had to change it. And that's, you know, we were young men then. Mm-hmm. I don't know how we would deal with something like that now. Still
probably
poorly.
Similarly, yeah.
Still poorly, but at the time it was...
It was the man.
At the time, exactly. At the time, it was thermonuclear. I wasn't about to be told how to write the strip I was writing for. Sorry.
That's the word. That was the word he was talking about.
Get right out.
See, that's been the problem historically. So I wasn't about to be told.
By the way, you get the belt. That's a Twit Network tradition when someone curses. You get an award.
I'm into that.
Yeah.
All right. I'm into that. That's fine.
So if you see our chat room in the IRC, they're all going, belt, belt. That's.
I'm into that.
Yeah.
Let's make it happen. But what I'm saying is that for something that I was doing for free, I wasn't going to accept any kind of editorial control. It was a product offered as is, and you can put it up or not put it up, but you certainly can't tell me what I'm going to put in it. And so at that time, we essentially jumped ship.
I mean, at that point, I think both of us knew enough very basic HTML to code that first Penny Arcade site.
Which was gruesome, but you know, it would parse in your browser.
Yeah.
It would be interpreted logically.
That's right.
We had some pretty busted frame code in there. But
yeah. But back at that time, I mean, do you remember, obviously this is going way back, but like Old Man Murray?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we had made friends with, you know, what is essentially, like, to this day, still the best gaming humor, in my opinion.
Wow.
It's
okay.
Good. You can go back and look at it, and it's still the best.
That takes me back, yeah.
But we had made friends with them, and now, obviously, they work at Valve, and that's a whole other story. But at the time, you know, they had equipment to host our stuff on, and they essentially gave us Harbor to host our own stuff and FTP access, and so we just maintained the strip going forward from there.
And you just grabbed a domain name? Was that pretty much your only cost?
Yeah, we couldn't get it without the dash.
Uh-huh.
Penny-arcade.com is all we could get.
I was going to ask you about that, because you still resolve pennyarcade.com to the penny with the dash, right?
Yeah, I mean, at this point,
that's, I mean, penny-arcade.com, I think that's what how people know it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. It was funny because when we were first trying to, a long time ago as young people, when we tried to sell ads and do this site like as our job, yeah. People would always say, that, listen, that dash, you got to get rid of that dash. Nobody's going to find your site. The dash is a huge problem, guys.
Yeah. The site's never going to take off.
The International Arcade Museum is going to stomp you guys if you don't. So you found safe harbor. You found somebody who's willing to give. This is a common story. I feel like where you know sort of luck into to friends on the internet, people who are willing to help out because they just like what you're doing. But the thing is, for all of those stories, most of them end up folding after a while, or the partnership, whether it's through acrimony or just through people getting different offers and going other ways, don't stay together. What do you think has kept you guys together and kept the site growing in popularity for 14 years?
Well, I think that a big part of it, I mean, this is something that we try not to think about too much because obviously there's the jinx factor. We want to try to minimize the jinx aspect.
It's like a Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
Exactly, exactly, but for humor. And, you know, the reality is that, you know, acrimony, like you said, like us not liking each other, well, that's actually built into the relationship. It's built into the strip, mm-hmm. and it's built into the creative relationship, where it is a kind of competition to outdo each other and try to make something that will impress the other person.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like the idea that I'm almost certain that if you did not base your relationship around that completely natural, normal force, you would probably run aground on it. But we accept that we don't like each other a lot of the time. And, you know, our archive is full of actual fights that we managed to turn into comic strips.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is there are times where, you know, I'll say something especially mean and really hurtful to him. And you know, he'll take a second to process that and then he'll shove it down deep inside and say, you know what, that'd be pretty good for a comic.
For sure. Well, let's talk about some of the good things that you guys have been able to do with your luck, specifically Child's Play, which is a great charity. You guys do fantastic work. There's always really fun stuff that's benefiting Child's Play. How did you come up with that? How did that come about?
I don't know. I mean, we felt the very first part. What was it? Was it really like that? We were angry.
I think it. Like most things that we make, it comes from anger.
So I wasn't kidding when I said that all of this anger ended up helping children. I'm glad.
Yeah. Go ahead. I mean.
Yeah. I mean, at the time that Child's Play started, it was sort of at the height of the video games are bad for kids.
They're murder simulators.
They
teach kids to kill, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that that wasn't the case, and we knew that gamers were not villains, and we knew that we had a large number of gamers who we could rally, essentially.
Yeah. And the initial idea, remember, was to get used consoles.
Right. We thought, geez, you've got all these people reading Penny Arcade, and all of them have used consoles probably collecting dust somewhere in their house. What if we could have them send all those old consoles and old games to hospitals so kids could play them?
So toys for tots, but for games.
Exactly.
Sort of. Yeah.
But then as soon as we started talking to the hospital, the Seattle Children's Hospital, they told us that
used toys are not a thing.
They can't accept used toys. These kids are in such sort of precarious situations that they can't be exposed to anything like that. Everything has to be new.
Mm.
And so that's when the concept for the charity sort of shifted, and we thought, well, what if we just let the hospital make a wish list and tell us what they want, and then we just point our, you know, Death Star laser of gamers at it.
And it worked.
Yeah, it worked. It's been working for years and years.
How do you come up with the kinds of things that are done for Child's Play? How do you countenance the ones that say, well, we're doing this and the money will go to Child's Play? Do you try to get involved, or have you run into people who are doing an event to raise money and if they say it's going to go to Child's Play and you would really rather they didn't, or didn't want to be associated with it? How do you handle that side of things?
Well, I think that's why we hired Jamie, because it was clear, like one of the strengths of the charity is that is that people can, is that it's sort of peer-to-peer in that way, where people can start something up if they want to and contribute the proceeds to Child's Play. There's a lot of energy out there, and you know, like I was saying before, like, people have things that they want to do, and when it's something that they believe in, they have an unlimited amount of energy for it. So they want to do these projects. And so eventually we needed somebody to manage that influx of enthusiasm. But like a lot of things that are deeply associated with Child's Play now, like let's
Desert
say the
Bus.
Desert Bus, Humble Bundle,
mm-hmm.
like those, that's, we did not make those things.
Yeah, but we only really run one event a year, and that's our dinner and auction.
Well, and now the golf.
Now the golf tournament, so that's just two. But, you know, when you see all these hundreds of Child's Play events, that's not us. You know, that's the community raising that money.
Yeah, and so we have an official calendar. If you go to childsplaycharity.org, there is an official calendar of everybody who has set up an event and talked to Jamie about it to get it set up. And so those are all the ones that we know about.
Yeah.
Cool. Childsplaycharity.org. Be sure to head over there. So Pong is huge. 1975, Pong comes out, something like that?
72. 75 for the home.
Ah, that's the breakthrough, the 2600. It actually was a standalone Pong game first.
Yeah.
Just Pong, that's all it did. It was two knobs. And then in 77, the Atari VCS. 2600, the VCS.
Right.
Huge.
Massive.
The world goes video game crazy. And I remember in those days, I was in the Silicon Valley, the Atari was, if you worked at Atari, you were like king of the world, baby.
Oh, yeah.
They walked around, those Atari engineers walked around like gods.
$0 to $2 billion faster than any other company in the history of the United States.
What was that like for you? It's a fast ride.
It was a fast ride. I was pretty insufferable.
I have to say, the people who worked for you were. I know a few of them. They were the king of the world.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then it crashed almost as fast as it took off. What happened?
That was after I left.
Warner Communications happened.
What really happened is Warner didn't understand the business that they were in. They perceived that they were in the record business.
Because that was their...
That was their business, and they felt that they could just build cartridges forever, and that they didn't need to worry about building a new player.
Oh, that's interesting. Boy, that's not kind of analogous to where we are right now with the old Xbox and PlayStation 3. Yeah. They haven't done updates in a long time on those.
I don't think they will.
Because we're moving away from physical media?
No, it's because the cost for incremental, I mean, I think it's silly to say my real-time visuals are better than your real-time visuals. Right now...
It doesn't really matter.
If you are more than X feet away, you cannot tell the difference between a good Xbox image and video.
Right. And isn't it about the gameplay anyway?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And plus... Right now, to just double resolution, you have to take... The heat is the real problem.
Yeah. Well, we know that with the Xbox.
Yeah.
And the Sony PlayStation, that's a supercomputer. That cell processor is a supercomputer.
Yeah, and so to up the ante just a little bit is...
The economics don't work.
The economics don't work. I projected 5 years ago that this was going to be the last iteration.
Interesting. You may be right. I mean, Microsoft said we're going to have a new Xbox next year.
But it's going to be...
How can it be much... They're going to have to do something besides better graphics. They're going to have to do Kinect or...
Yeah.
Headgear or something.
It will be derivative, not revolutionary.
Yeah. Really interesting stuff. We're talking to Nolan Bushnell. Okay, we've covered Atari. You sold it to Warner. You watched that thing kind of go bad. They made a lot of bad games, too. That was another problem. God, they were bulldozing game cartridges.
Well, though, that's a whole nother chapter.
And we talked before, but there was a Jack Tramiel of Commodore bought it and then folded it in his company. And then and now it's a French, publicly traded French company.
Yeah.
Started by Infogram. But it's still a brand. You know what's that is a great brand.
It is a good
and
brand.
That Atari logo, I don't know, anybody of my vintage looks at that thing and we know. That was a great logo, a great brand.
It's cool.
You did a great job.
Thank you.
Chuck E. Cheese, on the other hand, a little weird.
Always has been.
It was a huge success, though, right? I mean, how many Chuck E. Cheese restaurants were
there? There's about 580 now.
580. And they're still around.
Oh, yeah.
Are you still involved at all?
No.
No, you got out of that business. Well, we're going to talk about what Nolan is up to now. And, you know, I'm watching the chat room. And there's a lot of people in the chat room with a lot of thoughts. I'd love to hear what you think. We could talk more. You see, we have people who worked at Infogram when they bought the Atari name. People want me to ask you about Steve Jobs. Did you know Steve when he worked at Atari?
Very well.
You saw that memo that he wrote at Atari, just sold for, what was it, $27,000?
Right.
Because it's handwritten. I want to ask you, do you mind if I ask you a little about Steve? All right, we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Sean,
Steve Jobs. So you knew him very well. Did you hire him?
He actually showed up
barefoot
and said, "I want a job here, and I'm not going to leave until you give me one." And Al Alcorn did.
That's great. Al must have seen something. Although they tell the story that Al said, "Steve, you're going to be working overnight because you don't bathe enough."
That was actually my idea.
Was it you? So yeah. That's true.
That's true. But it wasn't really the smell that much. It was really more that Jobs didn't abide fools gladly.
Even then, he knew he was the smartest guy in the room.
No, but he knew that a lot of the people around him were stupider. I'm actually writing a book right now.
Are you?
Yeah, it's called Finding the Next Steve Jobs. And it's really about how you can take a company that is not creative and turn it into a creative company. Because what a lot of people don't realize is there's most companies are toxic to innovation by the way they're set up, and it's no surprise that certain companies do all the innovations because they have a corporate culture that is nurturing to innovation as opposed to toxic to it.
So what happens that makes a company toxic to innovation? I mean, doesn't every company want to be innovative?
Managers.
Yeah.
And fear.
Fear and managers. All right, tell me about that.
Managers, by their nature, are empowered by saying no.
Right. There's nothing to gain by saying yes.
Exactly. And so the more levels of management that you have to go through, the more probability you have of having innovation always ends up on the cutting room floor.
Because people want to play it safe?
Yeah.
It's risky to try something new, to do something different.
Right.
That's actually very telling. It's one of the reasons the music industry had a hard time adjusting to the internet. It's
exactly.
Why television's having a hard time adjusting. It's always easier to say, well, we're just going to keep doing the way we do it.
Oh, but it's even worse than that. You say, I do a lot of speaking for companies and things like that. And I say, how many people here believe in innovation? 100%.
Everybody does.
Everybody does.
Who's going to say no to that?
And then I have this slide that has two or three innovations on it. This is how many people believe in these?
What a terrible idea. Yeah, not on my watch.
So in the abstract, everybody thinks innovation. But on the specific, it's
well,
not.
Like what? What do people? What's an innovation that people say, oh, I'm not doing that?
Well,
getting up, sleeping 3 hours sleeping 3 hours on, 3 hours off, 3 hours on, 3 hours off.
Well,
there's an innovation. People try and they say it works really well.
Well, right now, we've got this product called Scrambles.
Okay, this is cool, by the way. In fact, it's on the web, on the lower third, scrambles.com.
But you cannot open a newspaper without identity theft, without kids, you know, seeing that people are stealing your information, reading your emails, doing things. And we have a very interesting, very simple to use product that allows private control and messaging. I mean, imagine.
It encrypts your messages.
Yeah.
And all you have to do is put at before the message, and it does it automatically.
Exactly. It's so simple to use. I would I don't think any kid under 21, and actually most adults, should be doing anything that's not encrypted.
Oh, I like that idea.
I mean, we've been, the Child Safety Network has endorsed us, the PTA. But more than that, just, you know, one of the benefits of yesterday was that you could actually forget things.
Not anymore.
And I can assure you,
I've read your Wikipedia page. Everything lives.
Yeah. And I can tell you that I'm glad that my Wikipedia does not go back to my high school, because I did some really bad stuff.
But everybody who's in high school today, it will.
Yeah.
Because they're recording it on the internet right now. And even if they're not, their friends are.
Now, if you use Scrambles, all your friends can still read it.
I'm signing up right now.
Oh, yeah. Everybody should do. And
do you make money on this? How do you make money on this?
We'll figure that out somehow. It's free.
But I'm glad to see that you have kept up with the Silicon Valley way of doing things. We'll worry about that some other time.
Well, it turns out.
So wait a minute. Does this go through your server, or does it? It's just software?
It's just software. What it is we don't know your secrets.
Okay.
And we provide what we call keys, you know, private and public keys and that sort of thing.
Right.
So we have a key server.
So this is public key crypto.
Exactly.
Oh, so it's strong.
It's real strong.
128-bit to 1,024 bits, do you know?
I don't.
Yeah. I'm sure it's...
It's strong enough. And it's... But the real thing about it is you can revoke the keys.
Oh.
So all of a sudden, all the messages that you've had, gone. I mean, they're still there encrypted.
But if your friend copied and pasted it.
Yeah. Nothing's perfect.
Nothing's perfect. This is cool.
I hope you're enjoying Triangulation. I know I do every week. Wednesdays, about 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. It's just, that's 2300 UTC. It's just a great show. A great opportunity for me and for you, I guess, to talk and listen to just these smart, interesting people. It's kind of my favorite thing to do is just interview really interesting people. I would do that all the time if I could. Actually, I guess I do, don't I? That's kind of what I do, isn't it? We got more coming up in a bit. First, a reminder, our shows on the Twit Network are brought to you by Ford Motor Company. You go further in a Ford. Ford is... one of the reasons Ford is on our network and is on is because they believe in technology. They are great supporters of technology, and they want to bring the latest technology to the car. They consider an automobile basically to be, in some ways, a consumer electronics device. And I love that so much. And I've gotten a chance by doing, you know, the Ford ads and going to CES and other shows to meet Ford executives. And to get to know them and to know their thinking. And I got to tell you, this is a values-driven company, really cares about what they're doing. They're not, it's hard to, sometimes you'll meet people who run a company and who don't, you can tell they're in it for the money. And this is not what you get from Ford. Ford is in it for some very deep reasons. You know, Henry Ford started Ford because he wanted normal people to be able to afford automobiles. They couldn't at the time. And he said, I want every person in America to be able to have an automobile. And so he figured out a way to make them affordable. Ford has gotten very focused on using technology to make cars safer, to make your experience better. But they're also very focused on environment. You know, they have sustainable factories. They've the materials they're using are increasingly sustainable. I mean, it's just impressive. They understand when you're a company that big that what they do makes a difference, changes the world, and they want to be good stewards. And I just admire that so much. I'm very proud to drive a Ford car. I drive a Mustang. My next car is for sure the 2013 Ford Fusion, because this thing is loaded with technology. If you look at the 2013 Fusion or the 2013 Ford Taurus, you'll see, ask for two different things. You want demos of two things: the Bliss blind spot information system with cross-traffic alert, and the active park assist. The Bliss has sensors. There's sensors all over this car. You know, I talked about the lane keeping, where the cameras in front. There's sensors in the back.
I guess they're cameras. I don't know what they are. Maybe they're radar that are watching vehicles in the other lanes. And when they sense a vehicle in your blind spot, they know where your blind spot is. They know there's a car there. They can't see it. It signals you. It puts a little light on the mirror and gives you an audible tone that lets you know there's a car in your blind spot. So you don't merge into the lane. Big source of auto accidents is merging into another car. Doesn't happen. It's also a great handy tool when you're backing out of a parking space and you can't see around the big car. You know, sometimes you get these big trucks on either side of you. It looks around the trucks and it shows you if there's somebody, if there's cross traffic. That's the cross traffic alert. The active park assist is just magic. It's pure magic. It parks the car by itself. It's kind of, I think it's kind of, it just shows you what that there is such a thing as an autonomous vehicle. You press a button. It looks for a parking space. When it finds one the right size, it says pull forward. You pull forward. It says stop. You press. It goes. The wheel goes. In 24 seconds, you're perfectly parked. It's amazing. You're this far from the curb. It's perfect. I love it. I want you to try it. Go to a Ford dealer and test drive the 2013 Fusion and the 2013 Ford Taurus. And learn more about this technology and the other great stuff Ford's doing at Ford.com/technology. You will go further in a Ford. I promise you. All right, back to triangulation, our last segment. I hope you're enjoying our best of 2012.
There's got to be some pressure. You know, when I first heard about how you were going to land Curiosity, I really thought there's no way they can do that. And you weren't able to test it, were you?
We were never able to completely test the landing system because the gravity on Earth is 3 times heavier than the gravity on Mars. So we can't run the landing system. We'd always crash every time on Earth. So we tested it in pieces. We did simulations. We, you know, counted on data taken in the 70s on parachutes and did wind tunnel tests. We did everything we could, but we could never test it end to end. And we weren't sure that it was going to work on landing day. It was definitely not a sure thing. So I was really glad to get that thing landed on the surface of Mars.
I think we could tell that because we were all glued to JPL during this landing. We watched with such interest. It was so compelling. And you could, I hate to say it, but I could see you guys sweating a little bit, right? And the relief when, as stage by stage, things went well was absolutely palpable.
Yeah, it was pure joy when we landed that thing.
I bet.
And you know, the guy, Alan Chen, who's the guy who's reading out all the events as they happen, he'd been working on the Curiosity rover for 10 years of his career.
Holy
cow. So it was all on the line right there.
10 years of work on the line. And you did, you probably don't want to answer it, but how confident were you this was going to work?
I will say I wasn't 100% confident. But I will say that I was confident that we had done everything that we could and that we had the best people on the planet working on it. So you reach a point, at least I did, where I said, well, I've done everything I can and it's time to sit back and let this happen. And, you know, we'll eat our peanuts and we'll say our prayers and we'll see if we have a good day or not.
We all ate peanuts, by the way. I just want you to know that there were plenty of people here on watching our network, watching the NASA feed, talking about it and eating peanuts with you guys going, come on, baby, come on.
You know, we got a thank you note from the National Peanut Council 2 weeks later.
You sold a lot of peanuts.
I didn't even know there was a National Peanut Council. So there's something I learned from this mission.
I think I tweeted, is it okay to eat peanut butter? Because that's all I got. but when they told you, okay, so here's the idea. We're going to hover a platform. Well, there's a I guess first you have a problem. How do we land this without stirring up so much dust that the thing is useless?
That's right.
So what was proposed? I know the previous mission, I loved it. You bounced that ball. That was crazy enough.
That was, yeah, I would say that. And actually, it was kind of funny to hear people, they look at the sky crane, as we called it, with a big rocket pack and lowering the thing down. And they'd be like, well, that looks dangerous. Why don't you do it the way you did it last time? And when you kind of step back and you go, well, the last time we took a whole bunch of airbags and blew it up and bounced it on the surface. You know, starting from scratch, would you really say that that's a more reasonable way to land? You kind of get used to it after a while. It's funny what people get used to, right? Well, we did it like that last time. It must be safe.
It worked.
It worked, right? Well, it looked just as crazy the first time they did it in 1996.
I agree 100%.
Yeah.
So who was it that came up with the idea of, okay, we will – in fact, we had – for our coverage, we had an interview with Steve Sell, who, of course, was responsible for that sky crane. Was it Steve's idea to do that? Who came up with that one?
I don't actually know the person who came up with it. I think there's a team of people yeah. who worked on it hard. And it's one of these things where in its initial conception on the back of a napkin, it looks kind of crazy. But when you think about it and makes you go, sense. Well, would you really rather have the rockets on the bottom right. or on the top? Actually, right. you'd really rather have the rockets on the top.
Right.
And everything else kind of drops out naturally from that if you work your way through the math and all the different options that you got. So it looks crazy, but it is really the product of great engineers doing their best to come up with the best way to land.
Well, and it makes engineering rock stars. It's like these guys are the coolest guys on the planet because they not only dreamed it up, they figured out the equations. They never got to test it, and they had the confidence to say, you know, this will work, and do it, and it did.
Absolutely, it did.
It worked! And I think some of the pleasure of seeing it work was the sense that it might not work, right?
Oh, absolutely. It was an absolute load off my shoulders to see that thing on the ground. It was just a tremendous weight, I think, for all of us to watch it and go, is this going to land? Is it going to land? But it did. And so now we can be happy and maybe someday we'll get to do it again. So it's a good day.
Let's talk about Curiosity. It's the size of a Volkswagen.
Right.
Is that the biggest thing we've ever landed on a foreign body? It's bigger than the Apollo, right?
I don't think it's bigger than the Apollo landers. Those are pretty
big. Those are big. You're right. Yeah.
Because we didn't have to carry a person.
Right.
But we went a lot farther. We went 150 million miles.
8 months. Yeah.
It weighs a ton. It's certainly the biggest rover we've ever put down, and it's kind of the size of a Volkswagen. I'd say when you've got all the arms and appendages and the head out, it's more the size of a Jeep, a small SUV. It's really quite a thing there, and it has 10 scientific instruments on it. It has 2 scientific laboratories built into it where they took laboratories that would take a whole room on Earth and put them down into boxes the size of a backpack and packed them in there.
Amazing.
And it's got a drill, it's got laser, it's got high-definition video cameras, it's got all sorts of stuff on it, great stuff.
Incredibly sophisticated. And it's an interesting challenge because it's 14 minutes after you give a command that it receives it. So is it mostly autonomous?
It does. It actually has to do most of its work effectively autonomously. We, on surface, operate – well, first of all, when it landed, it had to do everything by itself because it's only 7 minutes from the top of the atmosphere to the ground, and we're 14 light minutes away, so we can't do anything to help it. It's got to do it all by itself. And then when it's on the surface, we don't talk to it all the time. We actually normally talk to it. We send orders to it only once per day. And then it goes off and does its thing and reports back to us at the end of the day. We look at what it did over the course of the Martian night, and then we come back and give it another set of orders the next day. So mostly it does its work autonomously.
The software that's controlling it, how sophisticated is that? I mean, is it you have effectively PowerPC processors on there?
Yes, we have a RAD 750, which is derived from a PowerPC. It is a much slower processor than you would see. It's in the 120, 130 megahertz clock range, which is to say 10 times slower than the processor in my iPhone.
Right.
So it's a lot slower. It's got 4 gigabytes of RAM. It's very sophisticated software.
What do they write that in? Is it C++? Is it?
It's actually written in C. It's written in straight C.
Straight C.
Yeah,
not Ada, not some special NASA programming language, just C.
No, it's not even object-oriented. It's just straight C.
I kind of like that, actually. I think that's good.
And do programming down at the bit level. I mean, all the drivers that are used on it are custom written for it. All, you know, down to the drivers that do communication and talk to instruments and run serial buses, all of that stuff is custom so that we know what it does.
Is that because it's so... all the hardware is so unique, or is it? Why is it that it's all custom written?
It is unique hardware. We use some standard serial buses and stuff like that, but we use them with our own protocols. And the hardware is all built at JPL in the United States. The processor's not the processor we get from outside, but many of the electrical boards, all of the parts that are machined in Pasadena.
Interesting.
It's really something that's made entirely in the United States.
Totally custom.
It's largely custom.
Yeah.
That is.
So that's why you have to write custom software. That makes a lot of sense.
And we're trying to do a lot with it in a relatively, compared to like an iPhone, a relatively not powerful processor.
Right.
And we have to make it super reliable because it has to be able to recover on its own. So it's not like the software that's running in a Mac or a PC. It's very different.
Well, and all software has bugs, but you can't afford really to have you can't crash the computer.
Yes and no. I mean, we actually deal with the fact that the computer may crash, and we build in as much as possible redundancy so that the system can recover. The system actually has two computers on it. There was one running primary, and there was another running backup. And there was some software running on the backup that would try and take over if the main computer crashed while we were trying to land on Mars. But again, it wasn't a sure thing. I think we were a lot happier to go down on the main processor.
Yeah.
Not and swap in the middle.
No. And have there been crashes? Have you had to press the reset button at all, or has it been pretty reliable?
We have had resets that happened. We had resets that happened when we first launched it, that we uncovered some bugs that were deep, deep down in the hardware that we fixed on the way to Mars. So that kind of stuff happens.
I think this is also part of the mythos of JPL, of NASA, of these kinds of missions, is the MacGyver-like ingenuity. that you know it's you only got what you got, and you got to figure out ways to solve problems that you may not have anticipated, or you have to anticipate as many as you can, and yet things happen.
Right, and a lot of the challenge comes from the time limits we work with, because you can only launch to Mars at certain points in time.
Right.
So if you have a hard deadline, and the deadline isn't something that some manager told you, the deadline is set by the alignment of the planets. So you're either going to make that deadline or you're going to miss by 2 years. Oh, and
really? Is that how – that's how the window is every 2 years or something like that?
That's right. There's a 30-day window every 2 years.
That's it?
That's it.
Oh, wow. That doesn't give you a lot of – you can't slip the ship. You have to get it out there.
Well, now it is true, in fairness, that the rover was originally supposed to launch in 2009.
Okay.
And after looking at how difficult it was, we decided, you know, we need to wait longer. So we pushed it 2 more years so we could land safely, which we did.
And the bit rate of the connection is what, 500 kilobits per sec? What is the bit rate between you and the
rest? Bit rate's a funny concept. So when you're on the surface of Mars, you don't actually talk directly to the rover. The rover doesn't talk directly to us most of the time. It talks to a satellite that's in orbit around Mars.
Right.
And that goes back to us at Earth. The peak data rate is around 2 megabits per second, which is a little faster than T1 line.
That's pretty good, yeah.
But you can only talk to it for a few minutes a day.
Oh.
So we get about, on average, 400 megabits a day, which is to say 50 megabytes a day down from the rover. And that, so like at home, I have a DSL line. It does 6 megabits per second. It's the equivalent of every day I get to go on the web and use my DSL line for 1 minute and then it turns off. And then the rest of the day, I'm just working off that 1 minute worth of data I got, that 50 megabytes, to try and decide what I'm going to send to it for the next day. And the next day I send it and I get another minute's worth of data to look at it and then come back. So it's not that much. But it's enough.
You've got to be very patient to be a space scientist, obviously.
You do have to be patient. Yeah. And we're also very strict in prioritizing what things are coming down when. And,
right.
And there's a whole protocol for making sure the most important things come down first.
That's it for Triangulation, the best of 2012. And that's just the beginning, because we've got guests booked for the next few months. I think 2013 is going to be a banner year. Karsten Bondi, our new producer on Triangulation, is just lining up some amazing people. And as we do the show and more people know about it and recognize it, we're able to get better and better people. And that's kind of fun, too. So please continue to watch Triangulation every Wednesday on the TWiT Network. Come back next week. We'll be here. And each and every Wednesday all year long. If you miss the show, of course, You can go back in time and watch the on-demand versions, audio and video, at twit.tv. I'm Leo Laporte. I thank you so much for your support in 2012. It's just been so much fun doing this job. It's not even a job. It's a passion. It's a love. And I look forward every day to coming in and seeing you and our great guests. So thanks for letting me do that. I, from the bottom of my heart, I'm eternally grateful. I hope you have a wonderful holiday season, a safe new year, and we'll see you in 2013. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.